Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Centre for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Beth.
And I'm Ava. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from neuroscience to psychology while occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
And this week on the podcast, I got to speak to Dr. Telly Davoodi, and she's currently working in industry, but before that did her research fellow at Princeton University and currently has a John Templeton Foundation grant. So it was actually cool to talk to someone who's not currently in academia, but has this incredible academic CV, like her work's amazing, but now is in industry and is still doing academia. And we speak about that a bit in the podcast about how that can work. And her research is on how we can have scientific beliefs and religious beliefs and beliefs in the unobservable. So things like what's the difference between germs and fairies and how children develop these beliefs, which is super interesting. And she also does amazing work because a lot of her studies aren't just in the US, they're also in Iran and China. I really enjoyed this episode, so I hope you guys enjoy it too.
My name is Telly Davoodi, and I am a cognitive developmental research psychologist. Currently, I work as a behavioral scientist in industry, but I still continue my independent academic research. And that research is also inspired by my degrees in not only in developmental psychology, but also I have a degree in education and one in philosophy, which are both fields that inspire my approach to research, but also taking a more multidisciplinary lens when it comes to understanding children. That's part of my research, but also some of the concepts that and topics that I study are inspired by that background in different but related fields.
So when I was looking at your work, you've got so much work. I'm very impressed.
Thank you.
First of all, we'll talk about your work on religious and scientific explanations. Can you explain what motivated this work?
During my PhD and also one of the postdocs, that I did a lot of research trying to understand, and this was, of course, building on prior work by some of my own advisors, but trying to understand how children and adults think of religion and science and whether there are any differences, if there are any, what are those differences, and what is the role of culture and context in religious and scientific cognition. So a lot of that work, a lot of my own work, but also other work showed that when you go to different communities and you look at how confident people are that scientific and religious unobservables, these are things like in the domain of science, for example, we talk about germs, we talk about oxygen, but these are not things that children themselves directly observe. They know about them, they act as if these things are real in many cases, but they have never observed them directly. And then in the domain of religion, we have a lot of entities, again, that are unobservable. These are things like God, angels, heaven. And again, people act as if these things are real and they play a role sometimes in people's decisions, but they're unobservable. No one has actually observed these things, especially children. And so we wanted to understand how what is the effect of culture and context on learning about these unobservables. And the findings show that in different communities, somewhat regardless of how religious the community is and norms around religion and religious teachings are, children and adults are more sure, more confident that scientific unobservables are actually real things that exist in the world, even though they don't observe them, than they are with regards to the religious ones. So they rarely doubt that things like oxygen or germs are real things that actually play a role in their lives. But even in very religious communities, some people doubt, and sometimes the same people doubt, that things like heaven or angels are actual real things. Inspired by this work, when I was doing my second postdoc at Princeton, with my colleague Tanya Lombroso, we wanted to test a theory that looked at the functional roles or the sorts of needs, psychological needs, that science and religion serve for people. And the idea was that science and the role that it plays for people has more to do with uncovering truths about the world, understanding how things in the world work, and just discoveries, showing us the truth about things, about the workings of the world. And we call these sort of the epistemic function of science. And epistemic in this sense means sort of truth tracking qualities. Whereas with religion, the main function is not necessarily to show us how the world works or to uncover the truth about the world, but other functions such as serving a role in our social lives, for example, or providing some sort of emotional comfort or acting as a moral compass or whatever it is that people use religion for, it's somewhat different than that epistemic function of science. So we wanted to test this theory, and explanation is a very easy domain to understand what people think about different frameworks or different domains in this sense, in our case, religion and science. So we mainly asked about first the relationship between scientific explanations and religious explanations, to what extent they coexist and why do they coexist? And then what are the functions? Is the theory that I just talked about, does that hold when we look at how people think about these explanations from the two domains?
I just am wondering, because I think this is so interesting. And as a scientist, I feel like, so when you do these studies or come into these studies or people are speaking about them, scientists, do you come in with the prior belief or the prior idea that the science beliefs are true and the religious beliefs are not true? Because that's something I've actually struggled with the scientific community, because I feel like there's scientists who have all this room for spirituality and religion, and then there's others who just are really like against it in a way that I personally quite difficult. So I'm curious, when you're doing these things and conducting these studies, does that come up? Or bias could also inform how the study's carried out. I don't know.
So the studies themselves are not about figuring out whether the scientific claims are true and the religious ones aren't, right? So they're about, it's about the functions of each way of thinking. So when you're in your scientific mode of thinking, you are more likely thinking about things that have these truth discovering qualities, right? So you want a scientific claim or a scientific explanation to, for example, be verifiable. That's an epistemic quality. You want the explanation to give you a cause and effect story of how things happen. Mm-hmm. You want it to be based on evidence, right? So these are all, or you want it to be objective. You don't want it to be based on people's opinions. These are all truth tracking qualities, right? It's not about whether the belief itself is true or not. You're not really evaluating the truth of a certain scientific claim. When it comes to religion, again, regardless of the truth value that you want to assign to your own religious beliefs, for example, you are, at least we in these research projects, we're interested in what function, what role do these explanations serve? And are they different, these functions and roles, from the ones that science is serving? And the idea was that, let's say you're now in your religious mode of thinking, you're likely not thinking about how does the world work? How are tides created in the ocean? You're thinking about, how do I fit in this new community? I have moved to a new city. How do I fit in? Where is the local place of worship? Or things like, how do I deal with the anxiety associated with death? And these are actual questions that we asked in some of this research. What do I think about what happens after death? So emotional and social aspects of your own thinking, of your own life, than the truth tracking features that science might offer. And the other thing I'm going to say about this is that I think personal values or personal beliefs are really hard to control for. But I come from a tradition that shows, based on a lot of evidence from across the world, the coexistence of scientific thinking and religious thinking. And so when I approach this research, it's not from a place of, oh, it's either science or religion. You've got to only think in one way or another. Because I've read about the research and I've observed the evidence that shows that these two frames of mind or ways of thinking can coexist without any apparent contradiction in people's minds. And that's, again, something that our research also confirms. Based on that theory that I was telling you about, trying to figure out whether the functional roles, or we can say the needs that the different domains satisfy for people, we designed these studies to basically test that theory. And the theory being that science serves the role of a truth tracker, and the main expectation that people have from scientific explanations is that they offer some truth about things. Whereas with religion, the expectation is that religious explanations, especially when it comes to some difficult questions about life and death, for example, that these explanations offer some other kind of value, not necessarily epistemic value. And these could be things like social benefits or emotional benefits. And so what we did in this study was we first had a large group of people, US only, and these were participants on MTurk. We had them come up with explanations for one of three difficult questions, existential questions, we call them. These are questions about life and death. These questions were, what happens after we die? Why is there suffering in the world? And how did the universe come to exist? And so we had a group of participants generate explanations for one of these three questions. And at that point, we didn't ask them to generate scientific or religious explanations. We thought the idea was that these are the sorts of questions that are automatically going to produce scientific or religious explanations. So these are the sorts of things that people think about, and both domains have something to offer when it comes to these questions. So after we had a lot of explanations, we then had another group of people rate these explanations and categorize them as scientific, religious, both, or neither. And then from that process, we selected 10 explanations per question for each domain. And these were explanations for each question that were rated by the majority of that second group of participants as clearly scientific or clearly religious. So basically, we then had 10 explanations per question per domain that we had our main group of participants see and then rate on several epistemic and non-epistemic qualities. And when I say epistemic, again, like we ask participants things like, tell us how much you agree or disagree with this explanation. So they first saw the explanation, and then the features that they were writing about the explanation were things like, this explanation is based on evidence. This explanation is based on logic. This explanation offers a cause and effect mechanism. Or this explanation is objective, not based on people's opinions. And then we also had them rate the explanations on the social value, for example, that the explanation provides. And those were things like belief in this explanation brings people closer together. Emotional values, these were statements like this explanation provides a sense of comfort or is anxiety provoking. And then also the moral value. And these were statements like, if everyone believed in this explanation, the world would be a more moral place. So we had participants rate the explanations on these features, and the findings very clearly showed that the scientific explanations for all three existential questions are rated higher on the epistemic qualities of objectivity, cause and effect mechanism, evidential basis, and logical sense. And then the religious explanations were rated higher on the social, emotional, moral values. And interestingly, even religious people assigned higher epistemic value to scientific explanations, although they also thought that the religious explanations offer some epistemic value in addition to the non-epistemic value. So there was some variation that we observed with religion, with people's own religiosity, but even religious people thought that the scientific explanations are offering epistemic value more often than the religious ones. And then I'm going to also actually mention a third study in that paper, which is my favorite, where we had yet another group of participants generate explanations to one of the three questions again. But here we gave different instructions to different groups of participants. One group was asked to make sure that the explanation that they're going to produce makes logical sense, offers a cause and effect mechanism, and is based on evidence. Again, those epistemic values. Another group was asked to make sure that the explanation they're going to produce is comforting, reduces anxiety, and offers peace of mind. So those emotional values. And a third group, a control group, was asked to just make sure that their explanation is clear and grammatical. And there we saw that when people are told to focus on epistemic qualities of an explanation, they generate more scientific explanations, whereas when they're told to focus on the emotional values that an explanation can provide, they generate more religious values. And these were compared to the control group, who was just told to generate explanations that are grammatical. And so compared to that group, in the logical, evidential group, we had more scientific explanations. And in the emotional, comforting, anxiety-reducing group, we had more religious explanations.
It's just so interesting because I have a lot of discussions in terms of how we think of truth and cause and effect and everything. How there are scientists, for example, a lot of particle physicists. Mm-hmm. They're like, the more that we know, the more we know we don't know anything.
And mm-hmm.
And then that can lead them to these more religious beliefs or explanations. I'm just thinking like how that fits together. Because as we know, science doesn't answer everything. Mm-hmm. When we're thinking about cause and effect and truth, that's one of the issues. It doesn't tell us all of those things. And there's a lot, and I'm just wondering like how that...
Actually, this is also in the literature. There's different ways of synthesizing science and religion in an individual mind, right?
Yep.
There's different ways that science and religion come together in people's cognition. And one of those ways is what you're describing. Basically, that the more... And I was actually also part of a fellowship where religious leaders, rabbis, pastors, and scientists came together and discussed these ideas. And there was one preacher who I thought his ideas were really interesting. And he basically preached about this. The fact that his idea was that the more you know about how things work, the more you know about, for example, the inner workings of the human body, let's say, the more you see the wonders of God's work, if that makes any sense to you. But it was really interesting to me because it's a unique way to bring science and religion together without any contradiction. But it's not the only way. The other way that I think some of our data and our theory in the paper that we were just talking about supports is the coexistence, but in a way that in independent coexistence, let's call it, right? So the two ways of thinking can exist within the same mind and they coexist. Our idea in this paper was that they coexist precisely because they do different things and they don't come in conflict and they don't present any contradictions to the individual precisely because they are serving different functions for the individual. So when you talk to a highly religious, highly accomplished physicist, and you ask them, how do you make sense of your religious and scientific beliefs? They're going to potentially be surprised by the question, unless they have been exposed to these sorts of discussions, right? Because they don't bring to mind the religious beliefs or ideas in the lab when they are designing their next experiment. And they also, when they are trying to figure out how to deal with grief or how to fit in a new community, they also likely don't bring their scientific beliefs to mind in those cases. Again, because they're serving these two different functions, it's really easy to see why they coexist and how they coexist. But again, this is just one of the ways of coexistence. The other one is what you were talking about, which is the more you know that you don't know things, the more you believe in the likelihood of something greater than you being out there, right?
So we'll talk about another one of your studies now that investigated the different forms of ignorance for scientific and religious beliefs. So are science and religion related to different forms of ignorance? And yeah, what are the consequences for ignorance about science or religion? Is that different?
Yeah. So you mentioned mysteries, right? The more we know that we don't know, the more we think about these mysteries in the world. And maybe those are the things that religion is concerned about. Maybe it's those mysterious things that science perhaps doesn't always have an answer to that religion is concerned about. And this is exactly what we found in this study. So what we did was we asked people to identify beliefs that they hold from each domain, but that they don't know the causal mechanism for. So let me give you an example, which makes it a little bit clearer what I mean. For example, in the domain of religion, you might believe that God answers prayers. But if you're asked, how does that happen, right? What is the causal chain from you praying and then God receiving the message and then answering the prayer? You may have no idea, right? It may even be a silly question. It may be irrelevant completely to the belief itself, the how and the why. And in the domain of science, in a similar way, you might have a belief that the moon causes tides. And when you're asked, how does that happen exactly? What is the mechanism? Some people may know, some people may have no idea. They may say, I don't know, but I know it's true. I have the belief. So these are the kinds of beliefs that we were interested in. We asked people to come up to tell us one of their beliefs, and then the how and why, the kinds of beliefs that they hold, but they don't know the how and why about. And then we ask them, what is the appropriate kind of ignorance or not knowing that you would attribute to this belief? And what we found was that for the scientific beliefs, what people think is appropriate, an appropriate kind of not knowing, is to say that it's unknown. Whereas in the case of religion, it's a mystery. So mysteries are reserved for the domain of religion, whereas unknowns are the kinds of not knowing that are more appropriate for science. And the other thing was that we also asked about personal unknowns. Is it that you don't know or no one knows? And in the case of religion, it's these universal mysteries that religion is apt for perhaps looking into. In the case of science, it's personal unknowns. So when you don't know the how and why about one of your scientific beliefs, it's just your personal lack of knowledge. This is also interesting because it's consistent with that theory of the two domains doing different things, especially when you put it together with another finding from a third study, I think from that same paper, where we showed that if people have a belief and they don't know the how and why, and then we tell them, actually, experts also have no idea how and why, their confidence in that belief decreases if it's a scientific belief, but it doesn't change at all if it's a religious belief. Basically, you don't know something. You don't know how God answers prayer. You believe that God answers prayers, but you have no idea how or why that happens. And then we tell you, actually, experts in this field, an expert who you trust and who you would listen to, also has no idea how and why this happens. And we had also asked them initially about how confident they are in the belief, that the belief is actually true. Then we tell them experts have no idea. Then we ask them, how confident would you be after imagining, after we told you that experts also don't know? In the case of religion, they say, I'm still pretty confident God does answer prayers. In the case of science, they lose some of that confidence, which again, if you go back to that theory about the functions of the two domains, this is very consistent because the idea is that if science's role is to uncover truths and to tell you about truths, to show you how things work, to tell you the cause and effect mechanisms, then if it doesn't do that, and no one knows how to do that, then science is not doing its job, right? So your scientific claim, your scientific belief is not doing for you what it is supposed to be doing. So you lose some of your confidence in that claim. Whereas if the role of religion, if the function is these other things, it's not supposed to tell you how or why things work. It's supposed to provide some comfort, take away some of your anxieties, right? Or provide a social bond. Then it doesn't matter. God answers prayers. And I don't know how and why that happens. And it also does not matter at all how and why that happens. I'm so confident that God answers prayers. It's very interesting how we basically found more evidence for that theory that we started this line of inquiry with by looking first at knowledge and then at the flip of that, lack of knowledge or ignorance. And the consequences, you asked about what are the consequences. I think study 3 that I was just talking about shows you the consequences about how does confidence and maybe even trust interact with the functions of these beliefs in the two domains. And again, we show that confidence, you can lose confidence in science if it doesn't do its job right, which is to tell you about how things work and why things work, to show you the truth, tell you about the truths. And you don't lose confidence in religion if it doesn't do that because it's doing other things for you in life.
Awesome. So now we're going to go to some of your other work that looks at how children develop beliefs about the unobservable. Can you explain, you've also touched on this a bit at the beginning, but can you just explain what these beliefs are? And yeah, are there differences in beliefs about unobservable concepts, like if they're like fairies or something compared to a germ? So they're both unobservable. Are there different beliefs about that when children are developing?
Yes. So we looked at what in this field is called ontological beliefs. And that just means beliefs about things' existence, the beliefs about whether things exist or not. And what we saw was that, again, in different communities, regardless of how religious the community is, children and adults are still more confident in the existence of the religious unobservables compared to the scientific unobservables. So this was a study where we looked at children in Chinese communities that are Christian within China. So that would be a minority group, minority religious group. And then we compared that group to Iranian children in Iran, representative of the population, basically in a religious community, children in families that are representative of the community, as opposed to children in China who were a minority. And what we saw was that, so we asked children about these beliefs and whether they think these entities exist or not. And then we asked them how they know to justify their belief about the existence of these objects and or entities. And what we saw was that in China, the minority, the religious minority children, very often cited the sources of their knowledge. So they said things like, my parents have told me about this, my teacher has told me, I have read about it in a book. Whereas children in Iran, and I believe that study also looked at children in the U.S., they more often just elaborated on their knowledge. They did not tell us about the source. They basically just told us things like, we asked them, does God exist? They said, yes. Then we said, how do you know? They said things like, because God created us all. So they basically gave us some explanation about the function of the entity, or they elaborated on the entity itself. And that was very interesting as well, because the idea is that in a minority community, you're aware. So it's not that children don't know that their beliefs are different from society at large. They understand that their beliefs are different. And we know that they know this because they go to the source. So in order to justify the belief, they cite the source. Whereas in societies where children are representative of the society at large, there is no reason for them to go to the source because they are consistent. Their beliefs are consistent with beliefs in society. This was another thing from that line of inquiry that we looked into. And then some of these findings and then other findings in the literature, I published an opinion paper where my idea was that, so there's basically arguments in the literature. There is many great researchers in the field who believe that there is no difference in the way children learn about the entities from the two domains. And the main mechanism of learning is testimony. Adults around you are telling you about these things, and they're acting and talking. These things from both domains are real and existing, and so that's how children learn about them. And it's the same mechanism, whether you're talking about the religious unobservables or the scientific unobservables. I published a paper where my idea was that, again, based on my interpretation of some of the findings, that in the case of religion, that is very apparent, that basically you're learning from those around you and the way they are describing these unobservables. Whereas in the case of science, there's some evidence to suggest that the main mechanism may be children's experimenting with their own way of interacting with their worlds and trying to understand the physical world around them. And then maybe there is testimony on top of that, but the main mechanism is, again, their own interactions and experimentation with the world in a way. And so that generated some interesting debates where some of my own advisors then wrote a paper discussing this further and discussing the findings and other literature to emphasize the fact that it is actually testimony in both domains. And I actually love these debates. And I actually have no problem going over everything again and being like, yes, actually, it might be testimony. But I love the fact that there are these debates about what are the learning mechanisms in the two domains, and are they different or are they the same? It's a very fruitful discussion, I think, in the field now.
Yeah, it's super interesting. So I guess we don't have a 100%, we don't know yet. It's still up for debate.
I think people who are much, much more senior in the field than I am and have published so many great works on this would say that it's testimony. I like the paper that I wrote. Every time I go back to it, I'm like, this is such too. So I would say I'm at, let's say, I don't know, 60-40 at this point. 40 not testimony for both domains, 60 testimony for both. We'll see how it changes in the coming years.
Also, I wanted to ask, with that study you had, what was the process of having children from Iran and China? Because I know my friends who work in research on development and with children, it's complicated for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
But then here you're, was it done in person with collaborators? How did that work?
Yes. So it is very complicated. It helped that we had a very large grant.
Yeah.
And that just helps always. For China, and especially because the communities that we were speaking to in China were minority religious communities, we had to have people who knew the communities and could go there and were trusted by people, members of the communities. And so we had research assistants who helped with that and then went in person, did all the testing. And one of the grad students in the lab where I was a postdoc was basically supervising all of that, all the China data collection. And then in Iran, I went personally when I was a grad student. So I'm originally from Iran. And I went back, I think, one summer and then another summer. And I tested all the kids myself with some help sometimes, but it was mostly just me. And it was also a matter of just making sure that, of course, we had to have all the approvals here, but then also there locally, we had to have a lot of different approvals. And it is very tough when you're navigating that. There could also be a sense of sort of mistrust. Why are you talking to my kid? So we had to also collaborate with local universities there just to make sure that there's a sense of trust and that people know that this is for academic research and the data won't be published anywhere outside of academia. And I think another way to really address problems of reaching out and just making sure that our own communities of scientists are more diverse, but also our participants are more diverse, is to be a little bit more receptive to students and young researchers who are coming from all over the world. And then also facilitating those connections between researchers in different parts of the world, or figuring out how researchers from the rest of the world, from the non-English speaking world, can publish in journals that are read by many. So I think we have a long way to go, but it starts with individuals. In my experience, it has always been individuals going to different places. And these are individuals who are trusted, again, by the communities, and that matters a lot. And these are also individuals who are representative of underrepresented communities themselves. And I think this is the model, to start with these individuals who are underrepresented, who have a way in to underrepresented communities, and who know how to interact with these communities, and also sometimes who know what are the sorts of questions that matter to other communities. What should we even ask? Sometimes our research questions even are too US-dominated or English-speaking world-dominated.
So you followed up what we just spoke about, looking at children in Iran and how their beliefs about religion might affect other reasoning.
So the very recent work is not directly related to religious cognition. So I have another line of inquiry in my research that I started as a grad student, and my dissertation was actually on this, that I'm picking up now. It's on social essentialism. And that social essentialism is a bias that we all have. Children also have it, adults as well, to reason about social categories, different religious groups, for example, or to think about religion as an immutable, inheritable feature, an unchanging inheritable feature that is also very inductively rich. What that means is that it tells us a lot about people if we know their religion. So this is a bias that, again, we apply to social categories like religion, ethnicity, gender, and a lot of other categories have actually been documented in terms of social essentialism. In my recent work, I actually, undergrads from a university in Iran reached out to me a few years ago, and they said, we're interested in this paper that you published, which was part of my dissertation, looking at social essentialism about different social groups in the US and Turkey. And they told me, we want to do something like this in Iran. We want to understand to what extent children and adults here think about these different social categories as unchanging, inherent, and inductively rich. And so we started this project with them. They did an amazing job collecting data and writing first drafts of the paper, doing all the analysis. And this was, I think, about 2 years ago when we started the project. And very recently, we published that paper. And I'm actually really excited about that work because it was also my first experience as a senior author on a paper where I was advising students, mentoring them. And it was such an enjoyable experience. And also the fact that we had more data from Iran, which is a population that is very much underrepresented in research. And then we also followed up that work by taking an opportunity to do a replication. And we have published now stage one of a registered report where, so in English and in mainly the US, and I believe a few other English speaking countries, it's documented that among children, the way that people around them talk about these social categories influences the extent to which they essentialize these categories. And the term is generic language, and that's the extent to which people talk about members of a group as one group. Let me give you an example just to make that more clear. I can say women like pink, like the color pink, right? Or I can say this woman likes the color pink. If I say women do this and that, or women like this and that, that's generic language. I'm describing a general category. If I say this woman, that's specific language. And again, generic language contributes and in some cases causes essentialist thinking about the category. So women like pink, kids are more likely to think that women are the inherent, unified, inductively rich group. That has only been tested in English-speaking participants. And so we don't know whether that's a feature about English or a universal pattern. And does it actually happen with other languages as well? So we are now collecting data in Iran with Persian, looking at this link between generic language and social essentialism. And again, that's not directly related to the work on religion, but when you look at the category of religion as a social category, it asks how children and adults think about the category of religion. For the generic language study, we are only now starting to collect the data. For the other study, there was a lot of different patterns that are very, very interesting and inform this more general theory that we had about the interrelations between cultural factors, motivational factors, and then a sense of thinking of social categories as biological. So we are really showing the interrelations there. But one straightforward finding was that the patterns of how much children and adults essentialize different groups, including gender, religion, ethnicity, is very similar in Iran, Turkey, and the US. So you have very similar levels of social essentialism. And the interpretation of these findings is that the categories that where people more easily perceive them as biologically relevant, like gender or race, those are prime candidates for this bias, this essentialist bias, that the more you think that a category has some biological underpinning, the more likely you are to apply this bias, essentialist bias, to the category. Because we are going to different cultures, looking at different groups of people and seeing very similar degrees of this bias, especially with these biologically perceived categories.
So you've received this grant to study anxiety and beliefs in the supernatural. Is there anything you want to say about that?
Yes, I have to write that paper up. I have a first draft that I've been sitting on for such a long time. But the main idea or the main question was to see whether religion has any kind of an advantage, for example, or is religion uniquely suited to alleviate anxieties? Does it have an advantage when it comes to reducing anxiety? Or are there other ways of thinking, other frameworks that can do the same job? And in that study, what we did was, again, we generated explanations for specific cases. So we told people, here's a character. She either has a very difficult illness. So one case was health and the prospect of death. And the other one was financial hardship. And then we asked people to generate explanations that are comforting and that alleviate the anxiety of this character. And so we then took these explanations and, based on certain criteria, selected the ones that worked well with another sample. And then we had children and adults, this was in the US and in Turkey, rate how much they think these explanations are actually alleviating the anxiety in question. And again, these explanations were either religious, so they emphasized religious themes like God will help, don't worry, God is there for you, or they emphasized scientific themes like research has found that problems with this illness 90% of the time go away after 2 years, or they emphasized social ties and social connections. These were things like, you have other people to rely on, reach out to a support group or rely on your family, ask them for help. And then we had people rate these explanations and how much they think these were actually effective in reducing anxiety. And what we see is actually really fascinating. So remember I said with these other papers, we had shown that religion serves the social emotional functions more than science. Here we see that our social domain and social explanations are sometimes doing that even better than religion can. So science is still not doing that. But according to our participants, the social explanations are doing a much better job than the religious or the scientific explanations in alleviating anxiety when it comes to cases about illness, prospect of death, or financial difficulties. And this was also consistent across the cultures that we looked at, US and Turkey, and also among children and adults.
Wow.
Social explanations were doing a great job, which is also fascinating in light of all the new findings and discussions around the role of social connections for physical health, mental health, and the flip side, what loneliness can do, how much it can negatively affect your mental health and physical health. Actual diseases like diabetes, heart diseases, they are associated with loneliness. So that's another really exciting line of work that I just have to publish then.
All right, we'll be waiting.
Thank you. Hopefully soon.
So Ava, this episode was like close to home for me because do you know I'm really like spiritual?
No, I didn't know this. To
really?
Explain. I feel like we've never talked about this.
So the more I have been in neuroscience, the more I just feel I feel like people are going to not like this, but whatever. So I wasn't raised with a religious tradition at all. And in Australia, it's pretty multicultural. So it's not like at school we learn one religion or anything. But yeah, the more I learn about the brain, the more I'm like, oh, we 100% have a soul.
Oh, you do love the soul. Yes, that's
yeah,
true.
And that we don't know what happens after we die, but I really believe that, I don't know, our souls will be together in the universe. I really believe that. I believe in like weird, I don't know what it is, but like weird spirits or something in certain places, good spirits in others, all that stuff.
Why?
Because the more I know about science, the more I know that we can't explain so many things. And it feels like that is the only explanation.
What are the things that you feel like we can't explain?
So the other day I was really thinking about myself, so what I am. And I was thinking about my neurons and I was thinking about how I could strengthen a belief if I thought about something a lot and that kind of stuff and mental health. And then I just started thinking about that for a really long time. I was like, yeah, but what's under that? It's got to be a soul.
Why does there have to be something under that?
I just feel it. And in my lab, actually, I think I ended up getting really upset because I feel like neuroscientists, I know that there's two kinds. There's kinds who are just like, we're neurons, there's nothing else. And after we die, that's it. And that's the universe. And then you have another group of neuroscientists who are like me, and they're like religious because they're like the only thing that makes sense is something greater than us.
I think that we don't know everything for sure. I was raised super like extremely atheist. I don't feel like I identify with being an atheist now. I just feel like I identify as agnostic. I also agree the more that I've learned about science and how science is done and what we know, especially about the brain and about the mind, I feel like, yeah, we don't know anything, but also we don't know anything. So how can I subscribe to one specific explanation? And I think souls feel similar to me in that it's possible, but it doesn't feel any less plausible to me than once we die, everything's gone. Both of those things to me feel like they're possible and I just can't know. And I don't feel that I have a strong desire for that to be true. And that might be from being raised extremely atheist as opposed to, it sounds like you were raised more agnostic, like it wasn't something that super discussed. I think that I was exposed to a lot of contempt towards religion and I don't feel that way at all. Mm-hmm. I think it's amazing. And when I was younger, I actually really wanted to be religious because I thought it was so amazing. And I had friends who would talk to me about their relationship with God and how they would pray. And I was like, that's awesome. But I just couldn't do it. And so I think that because not just my parents, but a lot of people around me were so headstrong on atheism that they just really were like, it's totally cool if like we die, that's just what's gonna happen. And I felt not comfortable with it because it doesn't make me feel great, but I think just I was told so much that that is the case and we deal with that existential crisis of knowing that in other ways that I feel like, back to what Telly was talking about research-wise, the emotional and social part of religion, I think I got that in other ways. And especially when she was discussing that research about how when you actually ask people to have not just religious explanations, but like specifically social and emotional explanations, that those seem to work better to comfort people. I think that for me, that like those are the comforting things. And because I was raised so much with like, this can't be true. And now I feel maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but I don't feel that I have any like psychological desire to feel that anything else could be the case, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
No, that cool with sense. Like, it would be sad, but I think, and I think there's also something beautiful of our souls will never see each other again, Beth.
Don't, I'm gonna cry. Oh no. We always said I had to cry in an episode.
Have I cried in an episode?
No, but it was always gonna be me first.
Yay. I love you. It's because I love you so much and we have such a beautiful relationship and it's okay. If our souls meet again, that's awesome. But if they don't, we had today. We had Minds Matter.
Yeah.
The other thing I will say is I think that I have had an extremely easy life and that because of that, I don't right now need a lot of comfort. Yeah. And I think that I've seen so many friends who've gone through truly horrific situations and they're just like, yeah, I believe in these things now. And who knows, maybe it's just that pure emotional comfort, or maybe it's that because they've experienced something so terrible, they actually are able to access a different, not plane of existence, but they're able to see things in the world more clearly. And it's not to say that it could be that it's more clear. I think a lot of people will be like, oh, that person found God and they were so lost. It depends on which side. You can tell I was raised atheist. Like, the person who found God and says that they found God, they were just like, so broken and they needed something to like attach themselves to. Or maybe they were so broken that God was actually able to speak to them. Who am I to say? And I don't think I've been in that situation yet. God hasn't tested me. And so I think that for that reason, I don't need psychologically yet those types of things. And maybe I haven't lived through experiences that make me have that clarity that I might have later on as well.
Yeah, because I don't, or obviously I don't think this because it's, I don't think that people have these change in beliefs or find these things just because they need comfort. Because I think we're smarter than that. Do you know what? We're just not, I think, and not that, I don't know how to phrase it, but I just, because I've thought about this. Am I just believing all this because I want to feel comforted? And I was like, no, I just don't think that's true.
I think it can be both. Again, I'm just agnostic on the whole thing. I just think, I remember when I was younger, I wrote some paper about whether science was like new religion or something in high school. And then my dad coordinated me meeting this extremely religious student in his class who wanted to be a priest, and he was like super Catholic, and we had a really long conversation about religion, and I asked him the same questions that I asked you, like, why do you think that this is the case? And he said, because I wouldn't be able to go on if this was it. That sounds like comfort to me. Of course, there's probably more of that, like a belief that this is true, but I also think life can be so hard and it's okay to also want that comfort. And that doesn't mean that it's not necessarily true, but I think that a big part of religion and these beliefs is comfort.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I don't know. It's hard because I believe these things to be true. So my explanations of them are going to be different of why, because I think it is true. And I'm not saying I know exactly what it all looks like or what it all is, but I just think that there's too many, I feel like I'm going to do this and then maybe get, I don't know if I'll get canceled by the neuroscience.
Why?
I don't know, because I don't know how they feel. It depends. I also feel like I have connections with people and I just, there's something about it. And I'm like, there's something more than just this now. Or I don't know. I just feel that.
Yeah. And I think that's fair. And again, it could be like people who feel that they have premonitions and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of those people obviously are like quacks, but we have a bunch of senses that we've developed. And maybe there are some people who, for some reason, have something in their bodies. And that's something that could be eventually explained scientifically, but that just allows them to see things that we don't see, because birds can see more colors than us. There are so many things in the air that we can't see. There are gases that we're not able to see. We can't see infrared light. We can't see ultraviolet light. So obviously there's so much of our experience that we're not able to access. And I don't think it's crazy that you could be sensing something real, that you just are feeling something that genuinely is out there and exists. And it's just something that I don't feel. And yeah. I just think it's impossible to say whether it's like you're a sensitive girl and you need some comfort and your brain is like playing tricks on you, or whether you're just genuinely accessing something that others can't.
I also have just come from an island where there was like nothing. It was like very stormy and there was nothing going on. There were a few weird things happened, but
moving on.
But there were so many whales, like thousands and thousands of whales, and you could look off into this like beautiful ocean and it's all stormy and there's just thousands of whales. And a lot of these places also in Australia have a lot of important significance for the indigenous communities mm-hmm. and the wisdom traditions there. And I was just looking out into the ocean and looking at all these whales and I was like, there's something here that's more than the biology or the chemistry of the, there's just something that's like truly profound. And yeah, this sense of awe and wonder, and it feels like something beyond what we know.
But don't you feel that if we could explain that scientifically, that it would be even more awesome and wondrous?
But I don't think we'll be able to. That's the thing. I just can't picture a world where we can explain everything scientifically. And also, as we know, we have all these paradigm shifts in science where all of the science that we know completely changed. So like science, like alchemy was a science once.
Yeah.
So I think that just gives us some insights to some things. But I just can't picture a world where we can understand everything through science. Can you?
I think theoretically we could. I don't really see why not. Because I just think that in our everyday world that we know is science, there's so much magic that we just don't see as magic anymore because we understand it. But imagine if someone was like dropped into the present moment and was looking at us right now and was like, you're talking to someone in Australia. That's magical. That's just magical. And it's something that we don't think about as magical, but it truly is. And there's so many things that are magical. I don't know, even like the clothes we're wearing, that like all those journeys are crazy. And I think that a lot of awe and wonder is looking at the world that we have and appreciating it for even the stuff that we do understand. So I think that theoretically, I don't see why not in some ways, but I don't think that we will get there before our planet burns out. I don't think that we will ever get there technically, but I think that's okay. And I feel like that was just the message of the research that we heard about, was that all of these things can coexist and there's no reason to pit them against each other because they're serving different purposes.
No, and that's why I love this episode so much, because there's no reason to have a fight between both. And I loved that. I went to a talk once, a philosophy talk, and apparently a lot of biologists believe in souls, which I think is interesting. And they were trying to make this argument about how you can hold irrational beliefs and rational beliefs at once. And I got really angry because I was like, you can't say one belief is rational and one's irrational and label them like that. But I think it is interesting that biologists have a lot of belief in souls when they do so much with life.
Do you think, this is an uncharitable way of taking this, but do you think that it's because a lot of biologists are like, I know that I'm so smart and I'm doing this work and I still don't get it, must be impossible?
I'm going to say no.
Not you, but it could be. I feel like there's so many factors that go into it. It could be arrogance. It could be comfort. It could be, no, they really just know. I think there's no way of knowing. It could be cool to see how much these factors are contributing, except for, is it really real? But I do think maybe people who need more comfort or who do think like super highly of themselves, maybe that those are predictors. But that doesn't mean that these things aren't true. It just means that there are like psychological processes happening that we do understand that might feed into that.
Yeah. Have you ever been somewhere and felt like really scared, like there's some or something like that? Have you had an experience like that?
By something I can't see?
Yeah.
Like just had like a eerie feeling?
Yeah.
I feel like I've been spooked out sometimes, but definitely not that. I don't have access. Like, and I do believe that it's like having access to things like that, because I don't have access to contextual things and being like, oh, I can feel that there's energy. I have like no energy. Like even for myself, I'm really bad at telling what's happening in my body. Genuinely. And I think that's similar. Why can't that be connected to like feeling energy?
Yeah,
I don't feel that at all.
And I suppose because people also tell me a lot of stories about people who have had experiences with all sorts of things like ghosts. But it's probably because I like, oh, we can tell Beth and she'll listen and take this seriously. Maybe I have a bias in how much information knowledge I have from people telling me that, because they're like, something weird happened, let's tell Beth. <She'll->
I think that's the sticky part, is that all of these things could have these kind of more mundane explanations, like confirmation bias and just like who you're surrounded with. Maybe this is a psychological need that's unmet. And I think it's just wrong for people to purely explain these things with those psychological mechanisms, even if you can, because I think the only thing that we know is that we don't know. Yes, those things could be contributing, but I actually do think it's crazy for a scientist to say, I know for sure that after we die, that's it.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Because all we know is that we don't.
I think that's why I maybe struggle with some of the science perspective, is this, no, but we know there's nothing. I'm like, you don't know that. We don't know that there's nothing because we don't know.
Would you like to finish by just sharing what you're excited about, what's coming up next?
Yeah, I'm actually really excited about the study I was telling you about on the role of generic language. I think it can be a very important work in this literature because, again, this is such an interesting topic, and it's been really well documented among English-speaking samples, the role of generic language in social essentialism, or potentially in thinking of social categories as biologically underpinned. But I think it's very important and useful to know whether this replicates in other languages. And if it doesn't, what does that mean for all the literature on the role of generic language? I'm actually really excited about that. And this was my first experience with a registered report. So it was very exciting and rewarding to work on this, because you basically have most of the work done and published, and then you just have to collect the data. It's fascinating. And it was a very good experience, and I'm excited about the second stage now and also about the findings.
Thank you to Dr. Telly Davoodi for joining us this episode. Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Madisouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.